The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And a very good morning to you. This is the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. Donal Kavanagh with you until 12 noon today. We have a lot to cover on the programme this morning, but as always, the centre of this show and the most important part of this show is your views, your perspectives and your take on the issues of the day. What's important to you? Let us know. You can call us on 074-912-5000, 0035-374-912-5000 if you're outside of the dialing area. You can contact us via text or WhatsApp on 086-6025000. We're on social media, of course, at Highland Radio on X, Highland Hub on Facebook. You can watch the show unfold, actually, on our Facebook pages or our YouTube channel, Highland Radio Ireland. And you can see the Zoom calls, the studio guests and so on and so forth as they appear on the programme over the course of the morning. You can also email us, of course, comments at highlandradio.com. We'll begin with a look at the papers, and as it's a Wednesday, the Finn Valley Voice is out this morning, and the main story there, Finn Harps proposed new ownership model. Finn Harps proposing to move to a new ownership model as part of a plan to plug a €1.5 million funding shortfall for the club's new stadium. The details are to be presented to shareholders of the Finn Harps Cooperative Society at the Villarose Hotel in Ballybuffet on April 28th at 7. That's Sunday next at 7 p.m. Irish Independent this morning, and its main photograph is one of Lisa Lawler, who lost both her parents in the Stardust tragedy, with a rose for each victim. She's there with 48 roses. The headline above the picture, "Their unfinished stories became the defining story of your lives." Words from Simon Harris, the Taoiseach, who spoke for about 25 minutes in the Dáil yesterday and offered a formal state apology to the families of the 48 victims of the Stardust tragedy. And that's pretty much the main story across all of the papers. The main headline on the front of the Irish Independent this morning, victims of domestic abuse being forced into homelessness. Domestic violence victims are being forced either into homelessness or back into abusive relationships because the housing crisis is leaving women and children who flee with simply nowhere to go. Domestic abuse refuges across Ireland have reported cases where victims were forced to stay in refuges for over a year because of a lack of affordable accommodation. That's the main story on the Irish Independent this morning. Looking at the front page of the Irish Times main banner, "We failed you when you needed us the most." And then underneath, there's an interesting story from Jack Horgan-Jones and Harry McGee. More than 80% of asylum seekers coming from north, more than 80% of those coming in to Ireland are coming from the UK over the land border with Northern Ireland, according to the Justice Minister. She told the Rockfist Justice Committee, which held a hearing on the government's decision to opt into the EU-wide Migration and Asylum Pact, that the numbers believed to be coming over the border had climbed in recent months. The minister is putting it at 80%. She was answering questions from Fianna Fáil Senator Robbie Gallagher, Monaghan based, but of course born in Donegal. Also, President Higgins had mild stroke during recent health episode. That story on the news this morning as well. President Higgins has confirmed he had a stroke during the health scare that led to his hospitalisation during the first week in March. He was speaking to the Irish Times in Manchester, where he yesterday received an honorary doctorate. Front of the Irish Daily Mail this morning. Not in control of immigration. Most voters don't believe the government is on top of the crisis, according to a poll. Almost two-thirds of the public believe the government is not in control of the crisis. An exclusive poll for the Irish Daily Mail has found, it's carried out by Amoric Research on behalf of DMG Media. It revealed 8 in 10 people believe the number of immigrants arriving is too high, compared to 2% who said it was too low. 61% of people believe the government isn't taking their concerns on the issue into account. 64% agreed that they worried that the government was not in control of the immigration issue. Moving to the Red Tops this morning, and fair to say all of the Red Tops, their front pages and the first couple of pages in each of them is taken up with the Stardust apology in the Dáil yesterday. Looking on the inside of some of them, TV biker Dave left €1.6 million for his wife. Telly chef Dave Myers left a €1.6 million windfall for his wife, with her being named the sole shareholder of his firm after his death. Papers filed last month confirmed the ending of the Hairy Bikers star as a person with significant control of Sharpletter Limited. His wife's been given full control of the company. RTE brings back panel gig. Top stars in running for teleseries. RTE are planning a big new panel show with top stars vying for the job of host. Brendan O'Connor, Joanne McNally and Deirdre O'Kane could all be in the running. Bosses revealed they're looking for a skilled comedic anchor to host the midweek Mock the Week style show for RTE One Television. They say it'll be a comedy panel show that delivers sharp humour and the best comedic talent to Irish audiences. That will be a very interesting one if and when it comes to pass. Brendan O'Connor, Deirdre O'Kane, Joanne McNally. Of that threesome, I'd have to say I'd be leaning toward Deirdre O'Kane personally. But it's really a matter of taste, I suppose. The Irish Daily Mirror this morning, warnings as one in four admit to going on booze binges. Drink awareness campaigners warned of concerning trends amid new figures which show 60% of adults drink weekly and a quarter regularly binge. Some 26% admitted to regularly binge drinking in a survey prompting health warnings due to alcohol abuse. Links between mental well-being and alcohol consumption were also highlighted in the research from the awareness charity Drink Aware. That's according to the Irish Daily Mirror. And finally, the Irish Daily Star, tug of war on bikewat. And this is an issue I think that's going to become more and more prevalent over the coming weeks. We're coming really close now to Eurovision, and over 400 Irish artists have signed an open letter urging Eurovision entry Bambi Tug to boycott the contest due to Israel's participation. A total of 407 high-profile musicians, artists, dancers, writers and poets, including Derry Girls actress Siobhan McSweeney, singer and Senator Francis Black and Erica Cody, one of the artists that Bambi beat in this year's Eurosong. They're asking Bambi to heed the call from Palestinians to boycott the competition in the letter that was released on Monday on the Ireland-Palestine Solidarity Campaign's website. So it's an interesting question. Should Bambi Tug go to Eurovision? Should Bambi Tug make a stand and stay away? I suppose from their point of view, they're looking at this as potentially a huge mark on their career, as a huge honour to represent the country. And they personally, I'm sure, want to do it. On the other hand, I've no doubt that they're finding themselves in a moral quandary, as it were, because, like anybody else, I've no doubt Bambi Tug has concerns about Palestine and the situation there and has empathy for people. And, you know, it must be a difficult quandary to be in. So what will Bambi Tug do? And that's going to become, I think, an even more live issue over the course of the coming weeks. Eurovision, it's usually what, mid-May? Is it what, 2-3 weeks at this stage? It's what, usually, you know, second, third week of May, there or thereabouts. Can't quite remember. I don't know what the date Eurovision is, actually. If anyone knows, do let me know. But it's going to be fairly soon. Of that, I am pretty sure. That's the way it's looking on the papers. As I said, if you want to comment on any of those issues or any issues that are close to your own heart at the moment, you can do so at 086 60 25000 for your text or WhatsApp messages. You can call us 08 074 91 25000. Caroline producing and taking your calls, Shannon taking calls as well this morning. Or you can use our various social media outlets, or do so if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube. You can do it through the comments there. This is the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio, and we're going to talk European elections because we are joined in studio this morning by one of our sitting MEPs in the Midlands North West constituency, Fine Gael's Maria Walsh, MEP. Maria, good morning, you're welcome. In terms of the time you've had in Europe, it was 5 years ago that you went out on the campaign trail. How have you found the intervening 5 years? What have you learned and what's changed?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine 5 years has passed. And over those 5 years, I think if I stood in front of you or Greg, In that first interview, you know, I had a set plan in terms of making mental health, putting mental health on the political agenda, apprenticeships and traineeships for young people, because I had come through that myself, the West of Ireland voice and having that strong voice. And there's elements of that I'm really proud to have delivered on. But also within the context, or if you look at the round, as they say, in Brussels, of all the different challenges that we faced. I mean, I don't think anybody could ever write that a worldwide pandemic would stop us in our tracks 6 months in. We were the first democratic institution to go online, so that allowed us 705 MEPs right across the member states to do our work online in terms of voting on very much needed EU funding to get down into member states and local levels around COVID, in particular businesses that were experiencing and frontline staff, they're experiencing that harshness of, and which we are still coming out of. The fact that there is war in the continent, and there's multiple wars going on worldwide that are impacting, obviously, our citizens and those listening here and Highland Radio, as well as those right across the member states. But if you look at the aggression of Russia into Ukraine, you know, I work within the EPP group. That's where Fine Gael sits. And we have colleagues who are petrified that if the line is broken from Ukraine into the EU in terms of Lithuania, I think of Latvia, you know, that's a terrible consequence. And while I just, in my eyes, it reaffirmed these past 5 years how important our relationship is with Europe. Now, there's multiple challenges that we still need to continue to work on. Some historical legacy when I'm out with councillors and candidates in the likes of Killybegs in terms of fishing quota, in terms of the redesign and redevelopment of the common agricultural policy, because it's not fit for purpose as it stands for our farmers. But when you look at even our 50 years relationship, just over 50, you know, I remember a year or two ago being down in the European Direct Library down the road here in Letterkenny and talking about the marriage bar and the removal of the marriage bar for women who, when we joined in 1973 as a country, saw this piece of legislation that if a woman was getting married, she must leave her full-time job, part-time job in both the public and private sector and care to the home. Honourable role, can't take that. But the issue I always had with that is the choice. Women didn't have that choice. When we joined in 73, that had to be removed. And when you look at the 50 years where we're going in terms of equal pay, in terms of more and more women stepping forward in private equity and funding, yes, we do still do have challenges, all that I shared there, but we are a better and stronger country because of our relationship. So that for me, to answer your question in a long-winded way, there's so many aspects of EU that impacts us every day. 70% of legislation that my colleagues and I work on, both with this mandate and tweak those from previous mandates, 70% of that impacts this country. So it is incredibly important that we have that close relationship with the EU.
The Maria Walsh that's now on the campaign trail for election 2024 is a very different Maria Walsh that was on the campaign trail in 2019. And one of the major changes is going to be the public perception.
Yeah.
Because way back then, and let's be blunt, back then you were the young, you were the celebrity candidate, if I can put that in inverted commas,
retired Rose of Tralee.
The retired Rose of Tralee, your own personal life and your own personal choices. And, you know, and they were the focus and that was being spoken about. What's now going to be spoken about is your performance over 5 years, your track record. Is it easier to do it now because you can point to a track record, or was it easier? Especially, and let's be honest, now probably the most high profile celebrity candidate in the race now at this point in time is your running mate, Nina Carberry.
Nina Carberry, and it's fantastic. I just think it goes to show you, you know, 5 years ago when I put my hand up to get involved in politics and to all of that, you know, I was called the parachute candidate in quite a negative connotation. Mm-hmm. Equally, I went through that in 2014 as the Rose of Tralee, when people were saying, well, lovely ladies, with everybody knows that analogy from Father Ted. I'm really proud of the track record that I've had, given all that I've just shared in terms of the complications that we experienced as a European Union and as a country. There's elements that I've worked on that I'm really proud to move that needle a little bit closer to where I feel it needs. Making mental health a very much political conversation, not having yet delivered an EU mental health strategy, which I hope if re-elected, that's going to be my main focus. And that will ensure that across the 27 member states, we have a very clear plan, like we did with COVID, for health ministers to deliver as close to, if not on, the 10% budget set aside for mental health supports. And there's multiple other areas and angles within the mental health field that we need to tackle. You know, to your question, you know, I've grown a lot these 5 years. My political acumen has been raised. I'm really excited to have this ticket with Nina Carberry. You know, 5 years ago, I joined our first vice president, now Commissioner Mairead McGuinness, and a lot of people weren't giving me a fair punt to say, you know, the fact that, you know, I'm the parachute candidate, I didn't have the experience. But I would hope to you and your listeners that I've proven myself, as I know Nina Carberry will do the same. I mean, she comes from a fantastic, hardworking ethic like I did 5 years ago. So I think it just goes to show you people who grow up in politics are in politics, but equally myself and Nina, who didn't grow up in politics, are putting our hand up to get involved in it, to make our lived experience feel in policy, which is incredibly important, because sometimes there is a disconnect to Europe. I mean, I've been on the show several times chatting to you and Greg to talk about, well, it's so far away, it's so disconnected, it's so disjointed. But when you have people like myself and Nina stepping in, then you know that, well, I would hope people listening would know that we're here, we're listening, we're hardworking, we're gritty, and we're willing to roll our sleeves up and, to my case, have that proven track record of these past 5 years.
At the moment, in terms of national politics, it seems a perfunctory look at social media would suggest that Fine Gael are being blamed for all the country's ills at the moment. Are the letters FG on your campaign posters at this point a help or a hindrance?
Oh no, they're certainly help. I mean, we've an incredibly strong a strong ticket, and not just at an EU level, but, you know, yesterday I was out with Councillor Barry Sweeney, our new election candidate in Kellybegs, Manus Boyle, last night with Joseph Molloy in Gwydor, and covering the Glenties area. And when you look at those people, you know, many of them are already doing the job of a councillor, and we're doing it under the remit of Fine Gael. But most importantly, we're doing it because we believe in community service. And Fine Gael has been in government for several years. There is challenges in terms of healthcare and housing, and no one disputes that. But we need people in politics to run for people in a government or in a party that want to serve people. I think it's very easy, taking back in that Teddy Roosevelt quote that Brené Brown made quite popular recently, you know, there's a couple of choices when you're in politics, I believe, and this is my lived experience. You could either be in the nosebleeds, pointing out, saying they should have done this, this should have happened, I would do this differently, or you get in down into the Coliseum and really challenging people, and that's within the party as well as outside, and showing up to make that difference. And for me, Fine Gael is that, along with the colleagues that I just mentioned that I've been out with. Later on today, I'm out with Jimmy Kavanagh. So we've a really, really strong ticket right across the country and right across these communities.
As well as, obviously, as the Fine Gael affiliation, once you're in the Parliament buildings in Brussels and Strasbourg, it becomes the EPP. And a lot of people don't necessarily understand the EPP, understand how the system works. So very briefly, give us an outline of what the EPP is. And when you're in Brussels, what's foremost on your mind? Are you Fine Gael first and foremost, or are you EPP first and foremost?
Well, to answer that, I represent the Midlands Northwest, so now 15 counties. For those listening, that goes from Galway to Donegal Mayo across to Louth. We've moved from 4 seats to 5 seats. We are probably one of the biggest, most diverse constituencies in the EU. When you think half of Ireland, bar obviously Northern Ireland, very diverse, urban, rural, extreme urban, you know, you name it, we have it. To answer your question, when it comes to us stepping into the EPP group or European Parliament, you always do that with the vision that you have for your community. That's first and foremost. I'm a Fine Gael MEP who sits in the EPP group. The EPP group, we were one of the founding members of it. It's a farming party. It's a Christian Democrat party. It is a broad church. So there's those colleagues that I work on very closely with, women's rights in terms of access to funding. When I think of my Swedish colleagues, there's also those that we work very closely with in our common agriculture policy or our farming voice. Not everybody agrees with what we do. And we've, as a delegation with our head of delegation, Sean Kelly, have a very strong proven track record of standing strong when we need to in terms of the best interests for Ireland. And I think of the protection of the tax base and the basis of that. many of our colleagues wouldn't agree with that, but that's where the European Union, and that's where sometimes people forget, the European Union is built on consensus and negotiation, compromise, and sadly you do not get everything that you wish. The 10 things you're on your agenda list, you might not always be able to get them, but you're working towards them. And for me, working within the EPP group, or working within Fine Gael, is just as important, if not as important, as I work right across the political house. What is significant about the EPP group is we are the largest party, set to be returned as the largest party. Therefore, things like our leader in the president's role, Roberto Metsola, when I think of even the work of Ursula von der Leyen, when I think of the fact that we as an EPP group have about, I think at this point, 10, if not 12 prime ministers right across the EU. We have multiple senior roles at different committee levels, and we get our punt at legislation, which is why we're there. We write legislation. We work on legislation for people. So when you work within that largest party, then you get the best of the best, and you're able to work towards that. Smaller groupings, and I think at the left, where we have about 25% of our MEPs there, often don't get put their hands up and get involved in the legislation because they're the smallest group. In many cases, both the extreme left and the extreme right, in all the legislation that I've worked on, when I think of equal pay for equal work for women's rights, when I think of digital work around mental health, when I think of apprenticeship and traineeships, sadly, representatives, MEPs who've been assigned from the left and right to work on those don't even show up. So it just goes to show you that centre voice, that progressive voice, is incredibly important. Hence the reason why, from my side, the EPP group is best for us and best for in my eyes, for serving the people.
One of the major problems, obviously, in Donegal in recent years has been defective blocks, and will continue to be for the years to come. There was a very important report produced mm-hmm. by the European Parliament and a decision taken. When people started drilling down into the decisions taken before that report was published and everything was finalised following the delegation that came to Donegal, Mayo and other counties last year, there was question marks over some of the amendments that were proposed, and some of those amendments proposed by the EPP in terms of whether or not they were going to be favourable to Donegal. Looking at where it stands now mm-hmm. with regards to defective blocks in the European Parliament, are you satisfied that the right decisions were made by the Parliament and that what the Parliament has done can make a difference and can have a positive impact on what's happening locally?
Yeah, just to those listening, so there, from a technical side, you know, there was two amendments, one that I was glad didn't pass, another that I'm angered. Let me phrase that differently because I'm even confusing myself. So we had an Amendment 11 which voted directly before the EPP involving language around force majeure. Mm-hmm. And force majeure, in my eyes, should have never even been near anything to do with this this report around defective blocks. For those listening, it means it's an act of God, which this wasn't the case. Yeah. I've been very, very clear. I support 100% redress. I've been working towards that. Language like that, submitted by an EPP colleague of mine, is not okay. And I worked really hard to have that removed. When that couldn't be removed, then I worked right across the political house to make sure other political allies of mine in groups like the Social Democrats, in Renew, where Fianna Fáil sits, in the Greens, voted against, so that that would never make, and even within my own party. Some I won, some I didn't. That being said, there was another amendment which was voted against around 100% redress. And this is where it gets frustrating, because it was 12-4, 12 against and 1 minus, and it needed the majority. However, within the language of the report, there was a number of key things from the mission. I didn't personally put in amendments into the final recommendations of that report, because the six that were proposed for me fit what the micro redress group and other groups had asked for. And I think we need to do exactly what they're telling us we need to do. I think for long enough, people have been telling them stuff and they need support, not to be told and talked down to. So a number of things, like the cost of a new foundation included, the fact that the inner leaf is not even in this redress is outrageous. And that was included. Take better account for financial burden of all costs that include rental costs, provisional accommodation, that would all be fit in. Having better, if not the most significant point, market surveillance. So this doesn't happen again, but equally it stops now. Having better resources when we talk about staffing in the likes of the county councils, not just in Donegal, but in Mayo and other areas. And that 100% redress in terms of financial support in all aspects. So for me, that is where we're at. I'm proud of where the report sits. I delivered that to the Minister for Housing. I delivered that to the previous Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, and the new Taoiseach, Simon Harris. I also sent it to Donegal County Council, and I will continue to act and speak on that. I mentioned it. I said it very strongly in my convention speech, being put on the ticket with Nina Carberry, as well as the Ardèche, where I had speaking time and I spoke before thousands of people. Again, the Taoiseach was in that room. So for me, I'm very, very strong in that, and that's not rolling back. And we need to see change yesterday. And right now, it's certainly too slow.
Do you believe that that report will be taken on board by Simon Harris, by other ministers and by other coalition partners? Because the fear locally is going to be, yeah, it's a great report. Yeah, it says the right things. And yeah, it's going to sit on the shelf somewhere. And I know sitting on the shelf is one of the biggest clichés in politics. And it's a cliché because it's true a lot of the time.
Well, I think to the point, different political priorities step in. But this has been... Oh, I mean, families, and I meet some families with John McGuinness later on today, who are experiencing this day in, day out. So putting something on the shelf, to your point, is not good enough anymore. It wasn't good enough in 2011 when this really came on stream. It's not good enough now. For me, I just hope listeners know I will continue to advocate at every opportunity that I have to speak with leaders like Simon Harris. This will be brought forward. And for my eyes, it's as important today as it will be over this campaign, as it will be throughout until families see that 100% redress.
Human trafficking is an issue that you've taken a keen interest in, and there's been an important discussion in the Parliament in recent days. Where are we in terms of what needs to be done to take this issue seriously and tackle it head on?
Yeah, and I'm so grateful you allowed me to talk about this, because right now we have about 3,000 or 4,000 people being trafficked in and out of the country. That's what's being reported on by NGOs. Ruhama is a phenomenal organisation, as well as MECPATS, that do great work around advocating to end human trafficking. And when we think of human trafficking, sometimes we think of sexual exploitation, but it's also drug cartels that are grooming young children to sell of drugs. It's also labour exploitation. When you have people moving from different countries in the EU, often the eastern part, when they're moving to countries like our own, who are quite rich in the sense of our minimum wage and the standards of care within that. But you have some people that are not living up to that expectation and law. So it's a number of different avenues under human trafficking. Where this does is highlight the countries that are not doing it well, Ireland included. The movement of people needs to stop. Persecution, not towards the person being trafficked, but the person that is trafficking, is where this revision has come from. Stopping people from doing this in the first place. There's elements of exploitation of surrogacy and exploitation within marriage is also referenced, because we have some countries outside the EU and inside the EU that uses surrogacy as a way to exploit women in particular. That is included in, and ultimately a monitoring body driven by the Commission, signed up for by the Council, pushed by our Parliament, to make sure that countries are reporting and that we have a very even keel when it looks at human trafficking, because it needs to stop. It's happening. It's happening in this country. It is, for listeners, it is one of the most lucrative industries, but equally the silent one. And working with Gardaí, training Mark Gardaí to step into this role of monitoring this, ending this. And also, when I mentioned MECPATS earlier, they're doing phenomenal work at training hospitality staff, because often we know women and predominantly young girls being trafficked are coming in and out of our hotel chains. So for that's important work. But they can't see a reduction in their funding. We need to see an increase of it. So ultimately, as an EU player, that we're doing our part to end human trafficking.
Obviously, the situation in Gaza is very much on the agenda at the moment. And some in this country believing the EU isn't doing enough to support Gaza and to support Palestine. Where do you personally, and a listener is asking this, where do you stand on what's happening in Gaza at the moment? And do you regard what's happening in Gaza as genocide?
Absolutely. And I said that very clearly in all my statements. I also think the likes of Hamas need to be held accountable for the atrocities they committed on October 7th, but the retaliation by Israel government, Netanyahu in particular, is in my eyes beyond the act of retaliation, and now has very much shifted in these past weeks and months into genocide. For me, I've been very clear, along with our party, Fine Gael, that we need a two-state solution. We need an immediate and permanent ceasefire, and we need to see humanitarian aid, medical aid, food, therapy, you name it, and people living within Gaza need to see it, and we need to see it now. And as an American born, it's also really important me to stress the on the fence maneuver that the US are doing right now is exceptionally disappointing, because if we're silent in this, we're complicit to it. And for me, that's where I'm really, you know, proud of the fact that our previous Taoiseach and now current Taoiseach Simon Harris has been exceptionally strong on this. We need to see a review of the EU-Israel trade agreement, because within that language is around humanitarian rights and the protection of it. And we know Israel is not adhering to that. So everything we can do to create and stop and have a permanent ceasefire, create a two-state solution, recognise the state of Palestine, and then move forward is incredibly important.
You were saying there that the US are sitting on the fence. I mean, there's an argument that the EU is sitting on the fence as well. And you just remember the review of that EU-Israel agreement. I mean, that was raised with Ursula von der Leyen and others in recent days. And to say the least, they're prevaricating on it. There's certainly no commitment to that review.
I mean, when you look at the round, our president of the commission has done exceptional work in various areas. I mean, the response to COVID, response to the aggression towards Ukraine. It is disappointing that we haven't seen a very strong leadership role within this. I think that is moving, though. And you see, even in the last resolutions that we have passed in the EU Parliament. And what I mean by resolutions, for those listening, that is sadly no funding or no policy attached, but it sets a very clear standard and voice and tone where we sit as a Parliament on often an international issue like this. And for us, we've seen that dial moved, where colleagues right across the political house are understanding that we are watching genocide, and we're watching it through our screens. We're hearing reports coming through on our television screens, on our newspapers, and it needs to stop. And you're seeing that. And we need that bravery. We need that courageous leadership to have that coming from, to your point, Ursula von der Leyen and other EU ministers and prime ministers in particular, that are not supporting our call in a two-state solution and a permanent ceasefire.
But in terms of the current discussion, it seems that there's almost more concern within the EU Commission and within the presidency and at the top level. There seems to be more concern about what Russia might do in the late spring, early summer, than there is about what happened in Gaza last night and the night before and the night before, and sadly what's going to happen tonight, tomorrow night and the night after.
There seems
to be more concern about the potential for a Russian advance in Ukraine than there is about what's happening in Gaza. And it seems to be that's far away, whereas Ukraine poses a threat to us. And it's easy to cast Russia as the big bad boogeyman, but Israel is being treated in a completely different way.
I mean, I can't argue that. I think to also put to people listening, if we have a breakage of Russia further into Ukraine, into the EU, we're in a very different situation. And while it might seem very far away, even the Russia war towards and their aggression towards Ukraine, we have to remember we're an island nation. We're sitting between the United Kingdom and the US, that are third countries. We have a border attached to us. People in this county know that better than most. And we do not have a resourced defence force. And we also have a number of social media platforms housed in this country that feed into the other EU countries. So while opposition might say we need the language around EU army, boys and girls marching across the EU in this uniform, in response to Russia, couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, cyber violence, cybersecurity, the use of social media in terms of disinfo and misinfo is unsettling our democracy across the EU. So to that point, I think EU leaders are conscious of what's happening on our very closest to us, as well as further afield. I mean, there's multiple active wars going on around the world. We also have to be very cognizant that we have a threat very close to us that we know has created immense issues in our democratic state and other states like, I think, of UK, and they're playing Brexit. I mean, we have to be very real about that threat.
Marie Walsh, we could do this all day, and it's been a lovely conversation. Thanks indeed for joining us this morning. We wish you all the best on the campaign trail, and we'll speak again, no doubt, in the coming weeks. But for now, Marie Walsh, MEP, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
It's the 9 till noon show, 16 minutes to 10 o'clock. Let's talk about the Wild Atlantic Way, because the Wild Atlantic Way stretches from Donegal down as far as Cork. And over the past couple of days, from Wednesday of last week, I pretty much drove a lot of it, because I was down in Kerry and Cork, having driven via Galway and Limerick. And it was a really, really great couple of days. And the scenery was absolutely breathtaking. Imagine if we extended this so that instead of stopping in Inishowen, the Wild Atlantic Way kept going and went through County Derry and then over as far as the Causeway Coast and the Giant's Causeway. It could happen. It's under discussion. Joined on the line by Sinead McLaughlin, a SDLP MLA in Foyle. Sinead, good morning to you.
Good morning, Donal.
Sinead, you are an MLA at the moment, and you're a previous head of the Chamber of Commerce in Derry as well. This is something that's been on the agenda in the past, but now it's coming back into the discussion very much thanks to your party leader, Colm Eastwood.
Yeah, yes. I mean, we've been calling for the extension of the Wild Atlantic Way for many, many years now. It's a natural kind of growth of the Wild Atlantic Way to move into Derry and along the Causeway Coast. And the Economy Minister yesterday stated that he was supporting that extension and he was going to be engaging with his counterparts in the Republic of Ireland and Fáilte Ireland in order to see if some of the tourism brands can be extended right across the border. And I think that is absolutely a timely timely time for us to actually consider all island tourism offering, and it's great news for the city, and particularly and Donal, you've said that you've travelled the Wild Atlantic Way in the last week, mm-hmm. but absolutely some of the most spectacular parts of the Wild Atlantic Way are in the northwest coastline,
absolutely.
And that includes the Causeway Coast and Glens. So I think this is going to be a huge asset and a huge opportunity for the northwest, and we need to get on with delivery for the benefits are right across the region. We know that this brand is worth more than €3 billion euros to community across the west coast of Ireland each year, and we would like to see a substantial increase of that brand moving into the northwest.
We know that there has been some cross-border cooperation in terms of tourism, and the Tourism Ireland brand is ostensibly a brand that promotes the whole of the island, and it would appear that this is one way of absolutely making that real, because you can really package Donegal, Derry together, Sligo, Leitrim, Donegal, Derry, Tyrone into Antrim as well, that there is a whole potential to market the region as a region, and that the Northwest City Gateway and all that goes with it becomes more than a theory. It actually becomes something that's very, very tangible and real.
It is tangible and real, and it's happening, you know, organically at the moment. You know, tourists that come up along the west of Ireland actually move into Derry, and some of them are actually quite astounded that, you know, the brand doesn't carry through as well. So it is the natural extension. It will be really good for the promotion on this route, which brings benefit to all the outdoor activities, food, tours, pubs, restaurants, cafes, and the whole of the hospitality industry from Derry right through to the Causeway Coast and Glens. And you know, one of the very, very highly visited areas within the Wild Atlantic Way is actually the Causeway Coast, and we need to make sure that we, or the Giant's Causeway, should I say, and we need to make sure that is part of that whole brand of the Wild Atlantic Way.
As you said, Conor Murphy is making positive noises and is supportive of the idea. Now, obviously, there will have to be a discussion about the cost. There will be considerable cost in terms of signage, in terms of the various designations, in terms of all the work that goes into creating the viewing points and preparing those for designation and so on. You're confident that Conor Murphy is going to back up his support in theory with support financially, because this is going to cost money.
The investment into this is actually going to pay dividends back, and we can see that through the reports, as I say, from Fáilte Ireland, the 10-year reports. There was a substantial increase of 60% on revenue generated just a decade ago. So the investment, of course, it'll need to be investment, but the dividends and the payback will be quite substantial. And more than £6 million has already been provided by the Shared Island unit to link these two brands. So, you know, we're well on our way in terms of an investment in order to make it happen. And I just, you know, for the Northwest and particularly for Derry City, I think it's really important that the city is promoted as a key link in that connection between North and South, and a bridge for investment right across the whole Northwest region.
And there is no doubt that there is huge potential for this to be very beneficial, and anything that increases visitor numbers on both sides of the border, because I think you're right. If you can get someone as far as Donegal, they're most likely going to cross into Derry. If you can get someone as far as Derry, they're most likely going to cross into Donegal. And really, it's that sort of cross, the almost inevitability of, once you get them this far, the cross-border element is almost going to be, as you say, organic. The problem is going to be the marketing that gets them to the Northwest. Once they're in the Northwest, then we have them.
Yeah, absolutely. And extending the brand, you know, from Fáilte Ireland, you know, gives tourism NI then the impetus to actually market that brand, which they can't actually do at the moment. So, you know, extending the Wild Atlantic Way brand will act as an actual nudge to those visiting the Northwest, just as you said, to continue the journey into Derry and onwards around the North Atlantic coastline.
Emily Shea-McLaughlin, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning.
Thank you.
That's Sinead McLaughlin there. You'll have heard the statement from her party leader and the Foyle MP, Colm Eastwood, on the news earlier with Michaela. The prospect of the extension of the Wild Atlantic Way into Derry and on to the Causeway Coast. It's a very interesting one. Now, we are going to take a very short break, back in just a moment. Now, we're going to go to Zoom, and we're joined on Zoom by Angela, who is the PRO of the MICA Action Group. Angela, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Donal, and thank you for the opportunity to come on the radio this morning.
It is our pleasure. We spoke to Lisa Hone on the news yesterday. This is Angela Ward, the PRO. The documents that MAG got via Freedom of Information and has now written to both the Minister Dara O'Brien and the National Standards Authority of Ireland about are interesting. Tell us effectively what these documents you've uncovered say.
Okay, so I suppose just to give you a little bit of context then first, Donal, as a group, MAG, we're becoming increasingly frustrated and concerned with what was going on in relation to the fact that, you know, we have a live scheme which was never based in scientific evidence, and we had known that there was ongoing research being conducted and felt that we needed to glean information in relation to the status of that research. So an FOI was submitted, and what we found ultimately was that the NSAI and the Department of Housing have had the results of research for 4 months and have been sitting on critical information that should actually demand, you know, ASAP, a review of the legislation as it stands in relation to the DCB Act. Essentially, what was going on there was that critical information was known but was not being acted upon.
And one of the key pieces of information was that foundations at present are showing signs of problems. They're not as serious as the outer leaf. They're not as serious as we're seeing on some of the walls, but the problems are there and they very probably will get worse.
Indeed. Now, to date, I suppose the NSAI and the Department of Housing have been treating the defective concrete crisis in Donegal differently to how they've been treating it in other counties like Mayo, for example. So they had based their testing and remediation on a desktop exercise, essentially, that touted freeze-thaw action and mica as opposed to internal sulphate attack as the problem that was affecting our homes in Donegal. So that was based basically on expert opinion as opposed to any robust, rigorous scientific research. And the research, the information that we obtained from the Freedom of Information request was essentially that all research partners were in agreement that all parts of the home examined were being affected by pyrrhotite an internal sulfate attack. And it wasn't just the outer leaf that it was each part. So it was the outer leaf, it was the internal leaf or the inner leaf, it was the rising wall and the strip foundations. Now, the strip foundations at the minute aren't even part of that testing protocol. What the government had felt was that there were no issues, and this is what they've been saying all along, there was no evidence to suggest that there were any issues with foundations. And obviously there was no evidence to suggest this because no research had been undertaken. So we're seeing the exact opposite now, that there is evidence of liberated pyrrhotite within the strip foundations. And the research has stated clearly that there is early evidence of oxidation and the liberation of sulfur, indicating that the presence of ISA is ultimately a long-term risk. Now, they have said, obviously, that the risk, the level, I suppose, of deterioration in the strip foundations and within the inner leaf is less so than in the outer leaf.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's because it's kept dry and so on. But that is not to say that this will not become a problem further down the road. So it's clear that deleterious materials are in every single part of our homes.
And the fear obviously is now that houses remediated under the current scheme will be remediated, but we could now find ourselves in 10, 15 years' time with problems in the foundation, with more problems emerging. And ultimately the nightmare is that we find ourselves back where we started.
Absolutely. So none of the remediation options, not one of them, from option one through five, option one being a full demolition, addresses the issue of strip foundations. And the concern is that, you know, the same aggregate containing these iron sulfates has been used in the poured concrete, plus we have pyrrhotite found in all parts of the building, then this is only going to be a temporary fix. They're pushing us down. It would seem to be the, you know, a cheaper option, but an option that ultimately is going to leave us facing this nightmare in the future again.
Angela Ward, PRO of the Mica Action Group, thanks indeed for joining us this morning.